I'm Dr. Leif Tappanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History. I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho. This is The Nature of Idaho. Coming from the 1B, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of.
And I'm Peter. Before we start today, I kind of want to talk a little bit about ourselves and why we're doing The Nature of Idaho.
Why are we doing this, Peter?
It was your idea, so you should start first.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, so a little bit about me. I'm a geologist, a professor here at Idaho State University in Pocatello. I'm also the director of the Idaho Museum of Natural History. And my life mission is to study nature and to educate people about it and get people jived about it. So I'm a nature nerd, and one of the cool things in my history is I'm not from here. I'm from Canada. I'm from up far north. I grew up somewhere else, and I moved here for the job back in 2005. And I've been so impressed by the diversity that this state has, by the natural landscapes that it offers, and for the opportunity to go hiking out my backyard just, you know, minutes out the door, and we're in the beautiful mountains right here in Idaho. And I think that's such a special thing. What I've noticed is when you live here long enough, and I feel like I've lived here long enough, you almost take it for granted how beautiful this place is, how easily you can escape into wild places and witness nature firsthand. And if there's one thing that this show can do that I'd be hopeful for is that it sheds a little light on the natural world and gets other people to slow down and enjoy and appreciate the world around them. What about you, Peter? What's driving you?
So, like you, Leif, I am not a native Idahoan. I grew up in the other Iowa state where we grow corn, not potatoes. And I'm from Iowa, and I grew up on a farm. And our farm was adjacent to a nature preserve and the Little Sioux River year round. We were outside going for these hikes, swimming in the creek, swimming in the river, seeing all these different animals. And my dad kept telling me to stay out of agriculture because it's kind of a thankless job. You work long, hard hours, and all you really get is calluses. So what did I decide to do? I decided to go into the zoo business. So I work long, hard hours, and I get calluses. Right, but on. I got to work with some really cool animals. And I've worked in a wide range of zoos, from operating budgets above $100 million, down to $20 million, now to under $1 million. And I really do appreciate smaller zoos.
Well, why don't you tell me, you're at Zoo Idaho in Pocatello here, and what makes Zoo Idaho a special place?
Zoo Idaho is different. It is one of approximately 12 facilities in the United States that is strictly an indigenous zoo. And
oh, cool.
Indigenous
means
native, and native to Idaho. We've broadened it a little bit more. Idaho is found in the Intermountain West region. So we include the Intermountain West. Everything that you find in the Intermountain West, we find here in Idaho. What makes this so special is, much like you, the outdoors, the wild, holds a special place in my heart. And as we go through life, we start losing that connection. And we want to watch nature programs on PBS or the Animal Planet, and we want to help. We want to put our efforts into conservation, but that conservation is always somewhere else. It needs to start right here at our front door, and we really need to put effort into preserving what Idaho has to offer. And you were talking about the amazing landscapes, habitats, and ecosystems in Idaho. I don't know how many states have such a wide variety of ecosystems found right within it. And it's such a cool place. And people need to get out and experience nature at its finest, and Idaho is that area.
Well, that's a good point. You know, one of the interesting things about the history of Idaho and the making of the state, you know, there's TV shows that tell you how the boundaries of states were formed, and part of that story in Idaho is we are the parts that weren't taken by other states, in a sense. Montana's boundary is partly defined on the Great Divide. Our northern boundary with Canada, our western boundaries with Oregon, Washington, and our southern boundaries with Utah and Nevada were largely carved out by those entities.
Someone else.
By someone else. And so you could think, on one hand, that Idaho is the stuff that the others didn't take. But I take a different approach. I think of Idaho as a sculpture. By subtraction, we have sculpted away to leave the beautiful object that is Idaho. And the cool quirk of that is you end up with regions that are so different from each other, but are all part of the common group. The north, the west, the south, and the east are very different from each other, but together they work beautifully. And it's such a cool state to be able to enjoy.
I think it's, you look at these sculptures, they say the sculpture's hidden in the rock. And you just have to uncover it. And I think that's what Idaho is. It's uncovered. And we're helping everyone really appreciate Idaho in itself. Today, our first guest is Susan Ewing. She is a science writer based out of Bozeman, Montana. And her latest book is titled Resurrecting the Shark. We will be talking about the art of nature writing.
Well, that's really fun. You know, I've got An idea, Peter. How about every show we start off the show with a little trivia question, you know, something a little quirky, and by the end of the show we'll reveal the answer. So today, since we're going to talk about an author who has written about sharks, let's start our show off with sharks, which
Perfect.
Doesn't make sense in Idaho. Why would you talk about sharks? But maybe that'll reveal itself a little later on. Here's the question: How many teeth does a great white shark lose in a lifetime? Boy, I wonder. All right, we're going to go for a little break, and we'll be right on back to have our interview. And we're back. Welcome back to the show. Today, our guest is Susan Ewing, and Susan Ewing and I met a number of years ago. She's a science writer. Her most recent book is called Resurrecting the Shark, A Scientific Obsession and the Mavericks Who Solved the Mystery of a 270-million-year-old Fossil. And today she's our guest, our guest for episode one. One, because I know her and she's fun to talk to, and two, because she and I worked together on developing this book, which is all about Idaho's shark, and so that'll be a topic we'll get into a little bit. So welcome, Susan. How are you?
Thank you. I'm great, and I'm so honored to be your first guest on The Nature of Idaho. This is really fun, so thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely, and you're out in Montana, are you?
Yep, I'm in Bozeman, Montana, and it's a beautiful sunny day here today.
We'll let that part slide, but we are Nature of Idaho, not Montana.
Your neighbors to the north, northeast. All right. So, you know, you're a science writer. You've been doing this for a while. I'm familiar with your books that are geared at a younger age. My kids love them. What on earth got you into science writing and nature writing?
Well, I'm a science nerd, just like you guys are a nature nerd, and I've always loved nature, and I've always loved to be outside, and I was the kind of kid that turned over rocks to see what bugs were underneath, and you know, wading in the creeks. I grew up in Kentucky, so wading in the creeks to look for crawdads and you know, insect nymphs and whatever else was under there, and so I've always loved nature, and I've written some nature fact book kind of things about Alaska and the Rocky Mountains and some other pieces like that. But I just completely stumbled on the sharks of Idaho, and it was such an odd and funny thing. And I love odd and funny things. And And to imagine that there were once sharks in what is now Idaho just really captured my imagination. And then I got to meet you and Jesse and Ray, all part of those mavericks mentioned in the subtitle of the book. And I was just really smitten by the subject and by the beast of Helicoprion.
Yeah, for our listeners that don't know yet, there's this bizarre, it's the only word I ever have for a very bizarre shark that used to live here in southeast Idaho back in the days, long time ago, when this used to be the west coast of North America, and this was ocean. And there were animals swimming around right where Pocatello is located today, and Soda Springs. And the mines today that are digging up phosphate rocks and that sort of thing are the very same rocks where this fossil is found. So Susan, you helped help uncover the history of the story of this animal. And my job, of course, as a scientist was to study the fossils themselves. How do you go about piecing together stories like this from a scientific writing perspective?
It's a lot of research, and that sounds a little bit isolated from nature, but it's reading about nature. And also, I just want to say, too, that a lot of people don't think of geology and paleontology as sort of quote-unquote nature. You know, when you think of nature, you think of birds and wildlife and plants that we can see that are in the current universe as we know it. But the thing that I loved about studying this animal, this Helicoprion shark, is that it represents what nature used to be. And the more you learn, and the more I learned in my research about the history of the discovery of this shark, the more I learned about different aspects of nature. And the thing that I learned the most in researching for this book is how much the natural world has changed since the formation of the planet, and learning all about evolution and extinction. That was really interesting to me. And so my research took me on all kinds of tangents about people and about geology and about places. And I got to be really good friends with the interlibrary loan people at our library.
Yes, I bet there's a lot of reading going on. But there's also, you know, I think when we talk about science and nature, especially from a writing perspective, you know, science is a human pursuit that involves human beings who do stuff. It involves human beings who are idiosyncratic. It involves personalities and motivations and all of these are stories, right? These are storylines that can be really, I don't know, fruitful when coming up with a larger, broader topic, broader audience kind of a book.
Yeah, very much so. And you're right. Science is a human pursuit for sure. And I think a lot of people have this image of science and scientists as pretty sterile or, you know, not very fun or academic. And that couldn't be further from the truth. And that's another thing I found as I uncovered the story of the discovery of the fossils is there were so many different human stories and a lot of coincidence and serendipity and just a lot of fun and interesting stories. And I think that's the key to good science writing or good nature writing is to find the story, because as human beings, we need human stories. That's what we hang on to and what we relate to. And so to find the human stories that help tell the science stories, I think that's the trick.
And I think that's an important factor because we've all sat down and read scientific articles in a scientific journal. If you can stay awake during the whole reading, you're doing fantastic. There's not a lot of excitement in that type of science writing, and being able to interject the human stories, the process, how they stumbled into it, how they figured this out, as opposed to just seeing the results. I think that really makes for an important and enjoyable story.
Yeah, and it helps us see how other people interpret nature. That was one of the great benefits for me in writing the book, is learning so much more about the natural world than I knew before. I knew a fair amount about wildlife and ecology and things like that. That was sort of my background. But to learn more about earth sciences and the nature of rocks, the more we learn, and we learn through, you know, stories that other people tell us, the more we learn, the more we can appreciate when we go outside and take our own hikes or boat rides or whatever it is, our eyes are opened to nature when we can see how other people have interpreted it.
So you've written many books. What are some of your favorite books that you've written, and for whom? Is it for the more children's stories or up towards the adult books like our shark book? You know, what's your favorite book to write?
Yeah, my favorite book to write was Resurrecting the Shark, for sure, because it was a huge, meaty project, and I learned so much writing it, and I got to meet so many interesting people. But I also think I've written two picture books for kids, and those were, the first one was Lucky Hares and Itchy Bears, and the second one was 10 Rowdy Ravens. And both of those books, they're just rhyming picture books for kids, but Lucky Hares and Itchy Bears, each, it's a collection of 15 poems of animals that you might run into, like a lynx or a bear or an octopus. I mean, not in Idaho, you're not going to run into an octopus, obviously, but or bald eagles. And so each little poem had a nugget of natural history information in it, whether it's how many birds are in a nest or a story about migration or, you know, something like that. That was really fun. And I've gotten a lot of great letters from kids that they learned so much about nature from that little book. And then the other kids' book I wrote, 10 Rowdy Ravens, that's just a countdown book. It's a silly, kind of fun countdown book, and it starts with 10 ravens, and they get into all these misadventures until until it kind of winnows down. But there again, all of those kind of misadventures, like stealing shiny things or hanging from a branch or, you know, picking through the trash, whatever that might be. Those are all things that ravens really do. And you guys and your listeners, there's plenty of ravens in Idaho. I'm sure you all have your own raven stories. And then in the back of that book, there was a little section called Corvid News. Corvids, of course, are the group of birds that include the ravens, and that had actual stories of actual things that people had seen ravens do. And it's really fun and crazy. And they're just, it's so fun to see the wild things that these wild animals do.
Oh, absolutely. And people don't realize just how intelligent ravens are. There's not very many birds that really have the brain capacity that the ravens do. So it's a great fun way. People don't like this word, but I'm very apt to use it. You have to trick people into learning. That's right. A great way of tricking kids into learning something fun.
Well, do you have ravens at your zoo, Peter?
We've got a couple wild ravens that hang around year round, and it's great. We absolutely know where they hang out at. We listen to them for every day. We've got some crows that we've got two American crows on exhibit. And we've got wild ones that hang out. They're two females, and so we usually have a male on the outside doing his little mating call. And a funny story on that, I was talking to a group of kids, and we had a male up in a tree cawing down at our crows in the exhibit. And the little boy asked me what was going on. I go, well, he's trying to entice them. He's looking for a girlfriend, but it's never going to happen because you've got this mesh in front. And he, dead serious, he looks at me, he goes, well, how do you suppose he feels about that?
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Well, those ravens, you know, what's nice about learning about ravens is they're part of the natural world that's in our urban environment. So you don't have to go far away to observe nature. And that's sort of an underlying theme to anything that we teach our kids or the people that come over to the museum is nature is everywhere. And you don't have to go on some special jaunt in order to see them, right?
Right. And the more you learn, the more you see.
Yeah, I mean, we can just go to Mink Creek Trails here in Pocatello, and you're right there. The city disappears.
It's nice. That's a great thing about living in the Intermountain West.
Absolutely. Well, so we talked a little bit about this shark. You know, we didn't describe what it looks like. This is kind of funny and maybe revealing about myself. So I'm a science writer, but I'm the kind that writes the boring technical reports and where we suck the life out of a story so that we can, I don't know, describe it as perfectly as we can. And we use Latin language and it's not meant for just anybody to read. It's quite dull stuff. But then, you get a real writer like Susan, and she can turn it into something far more interesting than I can ever do. How would you describe this weird helicoprion animal?
Oh boy, that's been the trick of 100 years is to describe the animal, and that was one of the interesting things about the story. So, helicoprion, it was a shark. It's no longer living, and it has no living relatives. And it had something super, super unusual, which is a spiral of teeth in its embedded in its lower jaw. So it looks like a pizza cutter was stuck into the lower jaw of the shark. And it's a shark about the size of a great white shark. So an enormous shark, 15, 20, 30 feet long, who knows? And so if it were swimming towards you, all you would see would be this big mouth with this big barbed spiral whorl of teeth in the lower jaw. And the spiral didn't spin or anything like that. It was set into lower jaw, but so it would have looked like nothing that you would have ever seen before in your life if you were around 270 million years ago. But yeah, really bizarre looking. And the sharks don't fossilize well because they're made out of cartilage. That's one of the things that makes them a shark. And so the only thing that really fossilizes typically about these ancient sharks is their teeth. And that's why people find so many fossilized shark teeth. But you know, you see a fossilized shark tooth and it's just a single tooth. Like your listeners might have seen megalodon tooth fossils, big giant things like that. But this shark had a whorl of teeth like a snail shell, like the shape of a snail shell, but with tooth crowns all around it. It's really hard to describe without being able to draw a picture or use your hands. Or Leif, do you have a better description of the whorl?
You do a pretty good job of it. We're going to put a link to the book and a couple images of what this animal looks like. What's amazing to me is for over a century, people have been looking at this and trying to understand it. And, it takes some skill to try to articulate what this animal looks like. But, you know, there have been maybe 100 or plus of these things found. And most of them come right from here in Idaho. So it's our very own beastie, and we're pretty proud of it. You know, one of the things that Helico does is make teeth throughout its life, but it never gets rid of them. Great white sharks, however, they make teeth, and they're constantly shedding them. We had a trivia question right at the top of the show about how many teeth a great white shark makes throughout its lifetime. Susan, can you tell us what the answer is?
I will tell you, and you can imagine a drum roll, because a great white shark lives, sometimes great white sharks can live to 70 years old. They can be almost as old as human beings, and they lose 20,000 to 30,000 teeth in a lifetime. They shed them. They have like a conveyor belt system that they shed and generate new teeth. And so they, as far as we know, they never run out. They just lose their teeth and a new one comes in behind it. And so that's why it's so fun to look for shark teeth when you're at the beach, because wow, they shed them.
I'm just thinking of the orthodontist bill on that thing.
Boy, that's a lot of teeth. But, you know, as a fossil guy, that just means that many more fossils waiting in the rocks for the future paleontologists of the world.
That's right.
That's fantastic. Well, Susan, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you today, and we really appreciate you spending some time with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been super fun, and it's always good to help people get out there and fall in love with nature. We need more nature nerds.
We absolutely do. Yes, and completely. And we're excited for your next project, and hopefully we'll bring you back next time with your new book.
Very good. I'll keep you posted.
Thank you, Susan, for stopping by. Shows are recorded here at the studios of KISU Pocatello. Visit us at KISU.org for questions, comments, and audio for all our programs. Our theme music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock, and please remember to get outside and enjoy the nature of Idaho.